Well, thank you, Mike, for that introduction. It is very good to be with you this morning. I have to say, this is a very comfortable place for me. I spend at least a few days a week behind this podium talking to middle schoolers and high schoolers. So there's nothing too strange about being here. But it is good to be your guest this morning and to get to open God's Word with you. A little bit more about myself. So as Mike said, my name is Kyle Keating, and I have a wife, Christy, and an 8-month-old daughter named Kira, who unfortunately couldn't be here this morning because they have some obligations at our home church. We attend church at South City Church, which is a church in the Tower Grove neighborhood in the city. Let's see, as Mike said, I teach here at the school. I teach history and theology, but really my greatest joy in teaching at Providence is having the opportunity to prepare students to live in a post-Christian age. And that really is the theme that I want to pick up this morning as we look at the book of 1 Peter, is to consider what does it look like to live in an age and a culture that seems to become increasingly post-Christian. So if you would, look with me at 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 through 12, and that's going to be the text that we dig into this morning. The Apostle Peter says this: "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation." Let's pray together. Lord, as we encounter your word, we ask that you'd humble us beneath it. Help us to receive your word as instruction in our lives, as conviction of sin, as hope of forgiveness and the life to come. Lord, we ask that your word would go forth this morning faithfully, and that you would be glorified. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, I want to start by telling a story about the first time that I traveled to a foreign country. That foreign country was China, and China is, in a lot of ways, a very different country and a very different culture from our own. And you kind of know that going in. You know that when you're traveling to a foreign country to expect some things to be different, but you don't quite know what that's going to look like until you're there on the ground. And so for me, there was a very distinct moment at which I realized that I was in a strange land. And it was after we'd arrived in China, and we'd gotten off the plane, and yeah, we walked through the airport and everything was in a different language, so that was strange, but there was still a McDonald's, you know, so there was still some semblance of home. And then we got into our taxis, and I figured, taxi ride, I know what a taxi ride is like. This should be relatively, you know, another relatively familiar experience in a foreign land. And within about the first 15 seconds of that taxi ride, I realized that this was a very different thing in China than it was in the United States. Now, there are a few different reasons for that. One of the reasons was, at least in the city where we were staying, taxi drivers viewed the lines on the road as very loose suggestions. Now, we're not even just talking about, like, the white dotted lines, which, you know, maybe you can sort of weave back and forth a little bit. No, we're talking about the double yellow solid lines were just suggestions. And so if you needed to cross over one of those to pass multiple cars in oncoming traffic, you know, in multiple lanes of traffic, they felt free to go for it. And I remember about, you know, it was within the first minute of that taxi ride after we'd executed one of these crazy passes, looking at some of my peers that were on this trip with me in the back of the taxi and kind of just wide-eyed, like, where are we? And that experience, that was really the first real visceral moment where I realized, oh, this is a really different place. And there are aspects of that that are exciting. There are aspects of it that are terrifying. And so that is one experience of being a foreigner, of being a stranger, is being a stranger in a strange land. You know, I'm going to a different place, I'm not familiar with it, and so it's going to feel different to me. But there's also another way of experiencing being a stranger or being a foreigner. And that's when you experience being a stranger in a familiar land. And in a lot of ways, this is actually a far more disturbing experience. It's a lot more disconcerting because it's when you feel like a foreigner in a place that is actually supposed to feel familiar to you. Now, I don't know when you've experienced this, but chances are at some point in your life, you've experienced this sense of this is supposed to feel like home. This is supposed to feel like a place where I'm welcome, and I feel different. I feel unwelcome. I feel odd. Maybe you're an older person who's still single, and you realize suddenly as you look at the group around you that everyone else in that group is married, and you're the only single person, and you wonder, I feel different. I feel like even though no one said that I don't belong, I feel like maybe I don't belong. I feel like a stranger. There are a lot of different contexts in which we might experience that sensation of being a stranger in a familiar land. It might have to do with your race, your age, your class, your marital status, being married and not having kids, being married and being the only people that have kids. Whatever your context is, at some point you will have this experience of feeling like an outsider in a place that you're supposed to be an insider. Perhaps you've even experienced this in the context of the church. Well, this idea, this experience of being a stranger in a familiar land is an experience that Peter's audience would have known well. See, the Apostle Peter is writing to Jewish Christians in the Roman Empire. And these Jewish Christians were experiencing a great deal of persecution at that time. And many of the places that they would have called home were no longer safe for them because the Roman Empire was insisting on persecuting them. And so they had this experience of being a minority in exile, having a big empire, a big culture over them that didn't really appreciate who they were or the God that they worshipped. And I would say that our experience today as Christians is becoming increasingly like that of the Jewish Christians at the time that Peter wrote. That Christians today are increasingly a minority in cultural exile. We are, in a sense, foreigners in our own culture. And this might feel strange to us because maybe we had the sense that our country was a Christian nation. Maybe we had the sense that generally people around us had the same values, the same worldview as us. And now we wake up, we go outside, we look up and down our street, and we realize there are people even on our street that have very different worldviews than us, that have very different political views, that have very different spiritual views than us. And we also start to realize maybe we're becoming more of a minority. We see this in a lot of sort of specific ways in our cultural moment. Perhaps one of the most obvious is in our culture's view of marriage, which in the last 50 years has changed dramatically from what it was throughout the history of Western civilization. So we think about the advent of no-fault divorce in the mid-20th century, the idea that marriage is the kind of thing that you can enter into and leave whenever you want. It's really just a arrangement of convenience that's supposed to make you happy. And if it stops making you happy, you should leave. Or even more recently, the shifts in our culture's view towards marriage to say that marriage need not even be between a man and a woman particularly. All of these are just expressions of our culture's increasing shift away from a biblical worldview. And so in this sense, we experience perhaps this sense of being foreigners in our own culture. Biblical scholar Karen Jobes describes what Peter means when he's talking about being foreigners in 1 Peter. She says this, given the way that Peter develops this image of being foreigners throughout the letter, rather than understanding foreigners as describing believers' transitory life on this earth as a journey towards a heavenly home, it should be understood primarily as defining the relationship between Christians and unbelieving society. The Christian is a foreigner in a society whose values are based on other philosophies. So we're not foreigners in this land because there's some future land that's ultimately our home. We're foreigners in this land because it ought to be our home, and yet our culture and our society has increasingly rejected the God of the Bible. And often in the face of that, it's easy to feel confused, uncomfortable, and as an outsider. Jobs goes on to say this. She says, the members of a minority group have to deal with the unpleasant feeling of alienation and difference. They may choose to reduce the difference and assimilate their society's view on especially those issues causing pain, but this consequently diminishes their distinctive identity. She's saying that sometimes when you experience that sense of difference from your culture, the way you deal with the way it makes you uncomfortable is you just act more like your culture, because then people won't think you're so strange. Or they may choose to reduce contact with non-group members to reduce their experience of alienation, choosing isolation instead, and consequently forfeit their influence on society. So the other option would be to withdraw from our culture, right? So we might deal with that uncomfortableness by becoming more like our culture, or we could deal with that discomfort by moving away from our culture entirely. This give and take between maintaining a distinctive identity versus assimilating and participating in society versus isolation is a dynamic that is always in play for groups who do not share the dominant religion or worldview of their society. Jobs is saying that oftentimes you're faced with this choice. Am I going to become like the culture or leave it entirely? And actually what I think is that this is, in one sense, though it's a real tension, it's a false dichotomy. It's a false choice to have to pick between these two options. I think Peter actually gives us a better way to think about what does it look like to live in our particular cultural moment. So the question I want to use to frame our entire discussion this morning is, what does it look like to be a faithful foreigner in our cultural moment? And I think the answer is fundamentally to be a citizen of God's kingdom, first and foremost. But what would it look like to be a citizen of God's kingdom? I think Peter gives us three different things that would be true of us if we were faithful foreigners and citizens of God's kingdom. The first is that we would live with wisdom, understanding ourselves as citizens of God's kingdom first and foremost. Secondly, we would live with virtue, living out our citizenship of God as citizens of God's kingdom in front of the watching world. And then finally, we would live with eloquence, proclaiming the true King and his kingdom. So those are the three things that we're going to look at briefly this morning as we dig into the text of 1 Peter 2, 9 through 12. So the first point that I want to consider is that to live as a faithful foreigner in our cultural moment is to live with wisdom, seeing ourselves as citizens of the kingdom. Now, this question of identity, this question, who am I, is a question that is in front and center in our own cultural moment. And our culture has a typical answer to, or a typical method for discerning the answer to the question, who am I? Our culture's suggestion is, if you want to know who you are, all you have to do, it's very simple, is you look inside. You look inside yourself, and you consider, what are the things that I desire the most? What are the things that I feel most strongly? And those things are who I am. And one way of describing this is expressive individualism. So I want to know who I am. So as an individual, I look inside myself and I express that which I find there. What are the desires that I feel most strongly? And that is our culture's answer to the question, who am I? If you want to know who you are, culture says, look inside yourself. That's where you're going to find the answer. Well, Pastor Tim Keller suggests that this is actually not a very good way of answering the question. And as Christians, we will acknowledge that that's not a good way of dealing with the question, because for some very distinctive reasons. But Keller makes the point that even on its own terms, it's not a particularly good answer. And he gives it several different reasons. I'm just going to identify a few of the ones that he mentions. He says that one reason that this is not a good way to answer the question, who am I, is because if you look inside yourself, you're actually going to find that your desires are incoherent, that your desires are sometimes in conflict with one another. The Oscar-nominated film La La Land was all about the tension in the main characters' lives between would they sacrifice their profession, would they sacrifice their career for their relationship, where they sacrificed their relationship for their career. See, they looked inside, and what they found was that they had two competing desires, and they had to make a choice between those competing desires. So the notion of simply looking inside yourself and finding out what's there and then living that way doesn't work quite as easily as our culture would make it seem. The second reason that this is not a particularly effective way of answering the question, who am I, is because our desires are unstable. Think about how you would have answered that question by looking inside yourself 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Would you have answered it differently? Chances are you very well might have, right? Because your experiences and your life shape your self-understanding. And so your desires change over time. So what does that mean for your identity? Then that would mean your identity would be this very unstable identity that can fluctuate year to year, day to day. And then finally, Keller says that expressive individualism, looking inside yourself, doesn't work because it's actually illusory. The idea that if you look inside yourself, you're going to find some desires that are just yours, that no one else has influenced in any way, is actually an illusion. Because the desires that you have in here are actually a product of a lot of external influences, right? They're a product of your upbringing. They're a product of your family. They're a product of your religious background. They're a product of your friend groups. They're a product of so many different things. And so this notion of looking inside yourself to find out who you are, as though that's the one place that no one else can speak into, is actually not true as well. And so if this doesn't work, if it doesn't work to look inside to figure out the answer to who am I, we have to look somewhere else. And Keller suggests that what that means is that we actually need somebody else to name us. We need somebody else to tell us who we are. The only other thing I want to note here, the only other problem with the question, who am I, is actually in the structure of the question. Because the Bible rarely thinks about the question of identity in terms of who am I. It almost always, when it thinks about that question, asks it in terms of who are we. And so even in our own cultural moment, we have a lot of emphasis on you as an individual and the choices that you have to make. And yet the Bible seems to think about your identity not just you in a vacuum, but you as what community are you going to be a part of? Because our identity never exists in a vacuum of individuality. It's always communal. And so what does God say to us? How does God name us? How does he answer the question, who am I? Well, he does so through the Apostle Peter several ways in the text. He says that you are a chosen race. That's one of the identity statements in this passage. You are a chosen race. And this is hearkening back to the Old Testament passage in Deuteronomy 7:6, when God's people are chosen by God to be a blessing to the rest of the world. And so the implication here is that our identity is actually defined by God, not by us. You are a chosen race. You are chosen by God. God is the one who determines your identity first and foremost, not you. And then you will choose whether or not you're going to live in accordance with who he has said you are. And so the common cultural phrase of you do you ultimately has to give way to be who you are called to be. Secondly, the Apostle Peter says you are a holy nation. You're a holy nation. And this is the notion that God's people are set apart for service to God. To be holy is to be set apart for a particular service or purpose. And one of the implications of this is that we actually should feel like foreigners in our own cultural moment. To be a holy nation is to be set apart. It is to be a little bit strange compared to the world around us. And so a diagnostic question for you is, where do you feel least like a stranger in the world? Where do you feel most comfortable in our culture? And just to consider, why is it that I'm so comfortable there? Is it because I've actually adopted some of the cultural norms instead of biblical norms? It may not be, but it also could be. It's a good question to at least consider. A second implication of being a holy nation is that this means that our primary allegiance is actually not first and foremost to our country, right? If we are to be citizens of God's kingdom, that means our first allegiance is actually to God's kingdom before even our own nation. Now, this doesn't mean that you can't be patriotic. This doesn't mean that you shouldn't support our country or our military. It doesn't mean any of those things. But it does mean that when there comes to be a conflict between your identity as a Christian and your identity as an American, your first allegiance is ultimately to God. The third identity statement in the passage that I want to observe is that Peter says that you are a royal priesthood. You're a royal priesthood. And this means that that God's people are meant to be the means by which the nations, the rest of the watching world, may actually know God. That's part of what it means to be a citizen of God's kingdom. To be a faithful foreigner is to be a beacon, a light for the watching world. And so the implication is that we are to witness to the reality of God in our strange land. And we do so in two ways. One, by living out God's calling on our lives, and I'm going to call that virtue. And then also by speaking about the king and his kingdom. That's what I'm calling eloquence. Those are the last two things we're going to consider. So what does it look like to live as a faithful foreigner, to live as a citizen of God's kingdom? Well, I think it means to live with virtue. And where do we see it in the text? We see Peter's instruction to abstain from passions of the flesh, to keep our conduct honorable. The question is why? What's the purpose of living holy lives? Well, the text says, it says, so that the watching world might see your good deeds and glorify God. So how we live our lives in the presence of the watching world, in the presence of non-believers, in the presence of our greater culture is actually a testimony to the reality of God. In Jeremiah 29, the prophet suggests that we are to seek the good of the city in which we've been placed. At least that's his command to the exiles at that moment. And the application for us, I think, is that we too are supposed to seek the good of the communities in which God has placed us. And that as we seek the good of the communities around us, even the good of non-Christians in those communities, that will actually be witnessing to the truth of who God is. The second way that we live with virtue is that when we live, or the second implication here is that when we live with virtue, our lives function as actual witnesses to the gospel. So what is this? What could this look like? Well, I think it looks like a few different things, or it could look like a lot of different things. These are just a few examples. It might look like living with marriages that maintain love and integrity, right? We talked about the ways in which our culture's views of marriage have shifted. How do we speak a different word to our cultural moment? Well, one of the most profound and compelling words we can speak is actually by living out faithful and godly marriages. Our lives can be witnesses as we demonstrate loyalty and friendship, hospitality to neighbors, all these different things. And there are tons more implications or tons more different ways that could work itself out. But I do want to address one concern here, which would be if what it means to be a faithful foreigner is to live real virtuous lives in the presence of non-believers, what are you going to do when you realize that you aren't always virtuous, right? That's one of the pressures, the implicit pressures here is, well, if living a good Christian life in front of non-believers is part of my calling, then what happens when I fall short of that? And what can happen is then we can start to feel the pressure of, well, we better put on the good Christian face. We better act like we have it all together. Because, hey, the world is watching. And if they know how messed up Christians are, then maybe they won't believe in God either. And that's not at all what I mean when I want to suggest that our lives are witnesses. I actually think that one of the most profound ways that our lives function as witnesses to the gospel is when we are honest about our shortcomings, when we're honest about our weakness, and when we're honest about our desperate need of grace. Because actually, that's the point at which a non-Christian can totally understand, right? Yeah, I too experience weakness. I too experience brokenness. And I may not call it sin, but I resonate with that sense of, am I enough, right? And so that's one of the ways our lives actually function as witnesses, is not just putting on a good Christian face and acting like the good Christian so people believe the gospel, but actually admitting when you fall short of that and admitting your need for the grace of God as well. I mean, that's right here in the text, right? Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy, that's the thing that's distinctive about the Christian life, about the Christian worldview, is now you have received mercy. Well, the final thing that I think will help us be faithful foreigners in our cultural moment is to live with eloquence, to speak eloquently about the king and his kingdom, persuasively about the truth of the gospel. The text says, proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Later on in 1 Peter, the apostle is going to suggest that we should be prepared to give a defense for the hope that is in us. And this is part of our calling as Christians, is to be able to talk about what is it that we believe and why do we believe it. But how are we supposed to do this? First, I'd say, Peter's actually going to go on to say, you should do so with gentleness and respect. The word that I most commonly associate with this when I'm teaching my students is the word winsome. We ought to be winsome witnesses. What does that word winsome mean? It just means exactly what Peter says, do so with gentleness and respect. One of the questions that you might ask, especially if you're interacting with a non-Christian and you find that they're offended, is what is causing the offense? Is it the message of the gospel or is it the posture of the messenger? See, sometimes we can get those two mixed up and we think, well, they're just offended because the gospel is offensive. And it is true. The gospel is offensive. The gospel does offend our sensibilities. But sometimes what we smuggle in there is actually some of our own pride, some of our own conceit, and that's actually what is offending our audience. So if we're going to be eloquent witnesses of the gospel, we ought to be winsome witnesses. We ought to express civility when we disagree with people. The greatest enemy of civility and disagreement is the internet, right? Think about the kind of discussions that happen in the anonymity of the internet, in comment boxes on the internet. These are not the places you go to for good critical thought or empathetic reasoning. This is the place you go to see, you know, how many posts is it going to take for someone to, use an ad hominem attack, swear at somebody because they're mad at them. And the answer is not very many. It doesn't take very many to find that. And so part of what it means to be an eloquent witness is to have civility and disagreement, that when we encounter people that have very different worldviews from us, we don't treat them as enemy combatants, but we treat them as people made in the image of God, who, yes, don't yet see the gospel, but may indeed at some point. And then the last thing I want to say about eloquence is that we ought to be creative in our articulation of the gospel. This can look like a ton of different things. It can, if you're particularly gifted at rational thought, it might be using your gift in logic to make good arguments. If you're particularly good at conversation, creativity might involve eloquently expressing the gospel over long talks over coffee. If you're more artistic, creativity in preaching the gospel may look like making beautiful, compelling films or paintings or drawings. All of these are actual expressions of eloquence. They're actual ways in which we articulate who the king is and what the kingdom is of which we are a part. So to be faithful foreigners is to recognize that our citizenship is in God's kingdom. And as we do this, wisdom is going to help us know where we fit in God's story. Virtue is going to help us live out that story in the presence of our neighbors. And eloquence is going to help us share that story with our neighbors with both persuasion and compassion. But will it work? Will wisdom, virtue, and eloquence be enough to change this world that's made strangers out of us? I think that that's actually the wrong question, because it may not work. You may still experience some marginalization. You might still be viewed as a bigot. And whether it works or not is ultimately not the barometer for whether we are fulfilling our calling as faithful foreigners. The better questions to ask are questions like these: am I being faithful to the Lord's calling? Am I doing it in the community of fellow believers? Am I relying on God's Spirit? The passage ends with this note about the day of visitation, the day that the Lord is going to come back. And it's important as we think about, will all of this work as we experience this post-Christian culture, it's helpful to remember, what is the end of the story? How does the story end? Because in our own cultural moment, when we feel like we're increasingly becoming the minority, we might begin to doubt the direction that the story is heading. So it's helpful to know how the story ends. One of the places that I've seen this expressed most eloquently recently are in the lyrics from a song called Wood and Nails. It's by a group called The Porter's Gate, a compilation of a bunch of different artists that got together to make a worship album about work and what it looks like to express faithfulness in our callings in work. But I love how the song ends. It says this: The kingdom's come and built upon wood and nails, gripped with joyfulness. So send me out within your ways, knowing that the task is already finished. The dead will rise and give you praise. Wood and nails will not hold them down. These wooden tombs, we'll break them soon and fashion them into flower beds. The curse is done, the battle won, swords bent down into plowshares. Your scar-borne hands will join with them, serving at the table you've prepared. And so as we consider what it means to be faithful foreigners, it's helpful to know that that's how the story ends, that it's not up to us to change the world ultimately. It's up to Jesus, who already has, in his death and resurrection, which he calls us into. So let us rely on the God who's named us, made us citizens of his kingdom, that we too might live with wisdom, virtue, and eloquence as faithful foreigners in our own day. Thanks.